Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Happy Self Podcast, where we talk all things happiness from both a professional and a personal point of view. I'm Tracy Fox, an NYU certified life coach. I work with people all over the country, and I've written 4 books on happiness. You can find out more about me at my website, tracyfox.net. Today is a very special day, folks, because we are lucky enough to be interviewing August Turak. August is an award-winning author, speaker, consultant, and contributor to Forbes and the BBC. He is also the founder of the spiritual and educational nonprofit, the Self-Knowledge Symposium Foundation. August is a super successful entrepreneur and corporate executive who attributes much of his success to living and working alongside the Trappist monks of Metkin Abbey. Hold on, get your notepads out and your pens because you're going to want to take notes for this very fascinating interview. Okay, so let's start with, I think the burning question for myself and the listening audience is how you came to live and work with Trappist monks, because that's an experience most of us are not going to have, August.
Well, very quickly, what happened was that I was doing some mentoring for college students at Duke University, and they talked me into going skydiving. And as I like to say, I was brave enough to jump out of an airplane, but not brave enough to tell kids I was too old to be jumping on airplanes. This was 1996. I was 44 years old. And I jumped out of the airplane and smashed my ankle to smithereens. I compound fractured both the tibia and the fibula. I ended up in the hospital for a week. And suddenly I began having these terrible panic attacks. And I'm laying in my bed and these wave after wave after wave of panic is coming over me. And I couldn't figure out where it was coming from. And then suddenly I realized it wasn't about my broken ankle at all. It was the fact that it was my mortality. I was confronting my mortality for the first time. And even though I had considered myself a religious person, had been on this spiritual path all my life and everything, when I reached down for something for some kind of spiritual solace in the midst of all this, there was nothing there. And ironically, I had this, what we used to call in the 60s, this agonizing reappraisal, where I realized I was a total fraud, that everything I thought I believed in, I really didn't believe in. And I was terrified because all I really cared about was what the doctors were going to tell me. And I knew very well that one of these days the doctors were going to say, "I'm sorry, Mr. Turak, there's nothing we can do to make you comfortable." Then what? And this was the genesis. So I got out of the hospital. Finally, the panic attacks went away, but the deep, dark depression. So, and I went into what I call my 2-year dark night of the soul. And about 4 or 5 months later, I was at my desk one day and I get a telephone call from another one of my college students, a guy named Josh Skidlarik. And he said, I said, how can I help you, Josh? And he said, I just wanted you to know that at least one of your students took your advice. And I said, well, what advice? And he said, you told us to do something meaningful with our summers rather than just drinking beer and chasing girls. I don't remember saying that. I said, good. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm spending the entire summer with the Trappist monks of Metkin Abbey. And a couple of minutes later, I could just feel this change in his voice. And, I'd known him for 4 years. He had just graduated. And I just blurted out, I got to come. I want to come. And he said, when? And I said, now. And then I suddenly realized it was a Wednesday and I was at work and I'm the CEO of my own company. And I said, Friday. And he said, well, he was really taken aback. He said, well, let me go ask Brother John. And that was the first time I ever heard Brother John's name. And he came back a couple of minutes later and he said, Brother John said, come on down this weekend. And some amazing things happened that first weekend, almost supernatural things. And maybe there were supernatural things. And so I went back the next weekend and the next weekend and the next weekend. And then I applied for to become a monastic guest, which was what Josh was. And as a monastic guest, you get to live with the monks. You wear a robe. You live with them behind the cloister wall. You get up at 3 a.m. with them. You do everything. You basically are a part-time monk, or a temporary monk's a better word for it. And I applied to do that over Christmas, and they gave me permission to come as a monastic guest over Christmas for 3 weeks. And that was when the incident happened on Christmas Eve between me and Brother John, which later on led to my Brother John book. And so that was the, you know, the, I think people, I've been amazed with Brother John, how many people really do seem to pick up just how depressed I was on that Christmas. I was in the midst of the mother of all midlife crises, if you want to call that, or dark nights of the soul. So there was no, my trip to the monastery was not one of these anthropological, I've never been to a monastery before. You know, I've been to Rio for carnival, but I've never been to a monastery.
That's funny.
You know, no, there was none of the ordinary, and it wasn't just an ordinary retreat or anything. I was a desperate, deeply, deeply, deeply desperate man. And I went there desperately looking for help, which is what I found.
Wow. Well, okay. So that in itself is so profound and intriguing and inviting, because I think, you know, many of us would like to check into a monastery for a while. So what is life like? What is a day in the life of a monastic person involved?
Well, you get up at, you go to church 8 times a day. So the mission of a Trappist monk or Cistercian monk is prayer and work. And so it's a ora et labora in Latin, prayer and work. And they're contemplatives. So their main mission is contemplation, meditation, prayer. And so you get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and the first service of the day is vigils, which is at 3:20 in the morning. And you go to vigils, and then you go to lauds, which is the morning service. And then you go to mass, and then you go to terse. And then at noon, you go to noonday prayer. Then after lunch, you go to noon, and then you go to vespers, and you go to compline. And besides mass, which is a typical Catholic mass, they're all pretty much the same, which is it opens with a, someone sings that, "Oh God, come to my assistance." And all the other monks say, "Lord, make haste to help me." And then you say a prayer, and then there's a hymn, and then you chant psalms back and forth. The monks face each other in the church. So there's what they call choir stalls on either side of the main aisle facing each other. So one side will do the first line of the psalm, and then it will be sung. It's sung. And then you sing back the second line of the psalms. And after the psalms are over, then you have a reading from the Bible. And then you have some final prayers and another hymn, and then that's the end of that service. And in between, in the mornings, before you go to work at 8:30, what the monks do is what's called Lectio Divina, which means divine reading. And it's really a form of contemplation or meditation or prayer, where you're supposed to just take, instead of reading the Bible, you let the Bible read you. So you might just take one little verse, you know, and very, very quietly. And they believe very much in the early morning hours, where you're still kind of semi, not completely awake, is a perfect time for this exercise. And you'll take one verse, or maybe two verses at the most, and you just sit on it. You'd let it talk to you. So they do this Lectio Divina and meditation. So that's, then you go to work. And when I first started going there, they had 40,000 chickens and they sold the eggs. So I worked in the chicken business in the grading house, packing eggs, and or being in the chicken house, actually picking eggs, which means, you know, you run around with this picking the eggs and putting them in cartons to take out to get cleaned, et cetera. Now they're actually in the mushroom business. So they have these exotic mushrooms that they grow. And they also have a fertilizer business, and they have a conference center, and they have a bookstore, and they have they do a lot of different, they own timber, they lease the timber, renewable timber. So anyway, part of the whole Trappist charism is what they would call it, is to be self-sufficient. They provide for themselves. They have their own refectory there. They feed themselves. They have their own infirmary there. So they treat their own sick. They have their old age center. They take care of their old age people. So the whole idea of community is extremely, extremely important.
All right. So, you know, I think from your understanding, two very deep and important things happened at Mepkinali. One was a personal transformation. And the second thing had to do with sort of secrets of business success. So tell us about how you transformed your transformation from the deep depression to something else. What was the answer?
Well, the answer, I'm actually writing a book about the answer right now. It's interesting. But the answer was that I went through 2 years of of down, deeper and deeper into depression and despair. And then in the right, on, basically on Easter of 1998, 2 years later, I had this profound, incredibly transformational spiritual experience. The only way I can describe it is a mystical experience. And it cured me instantaneously. I had been battling depression since I was 14 years old, on and off. And I think finally what happened when I broke my ankle was not anything coming from nowhere. It was finally, it caught up to me and I couldn't push it back anymore. And that was 1998 that I had that spiritual experience, Tracy. And I have not had one moment of anxiety or depression in, what is it, 22 years now? So, and I've just had an unfolding of joy and peace. And actually, Melissa just posted onto our Brother John site today a quote that I had and something I've been that I wrote for the introduction for my Brother John when he came out as a book. I said that I say in my Brother John book that I didn't know whether his effortless peace and effortless love could ever be available to me. That maybe I didn't have what it takes, but I have now had that for 20 years. So I know it exists because it happened for me.
And so when you had, you say you had this spiritual experience, was it instantaneous? Were you, where did it happen?
I'm going to have to write a whole book about this, but I got so terribly to the end of my rope that I called actually he's a Methodist minister and he's a psychologist. His name is Bill Richards. I had worked with him briefly in 1980. I called him up in the spring of 1998. Lo and behold, he's still there. He still answered his phone. I told him my story. So I went up to Baltimore to work with him for Holy Week. And I chose Holy Week because of, frankly, just because business would be slow. So I got up there the Friday before Palm Sunday and started working with him 2 and 4 hours a day. Anyway, and again, it's the whole book because what happened was that all hell broke loose. And I started having visions and demons. And it's a whole book, but it lasted a whole week. And then finally on Holy Saturday, when I really thought I was at the absolute end of my rope, I had an instantaneous experience of, that is indescribable. I can't express it. I don't have any words for it. As a matter of fact, the next thing I really remember is standing outside of being at church with him the next day and standing outside after the Easter services were over and the bells were ringing for Easter and the sun was shining and it was like somebody had cut the top of my head off and the sunshine was going all the way down to my feet and I was floating 5 feet off the ground. And,
wow.
And everything, God was in his heaven and all was right with the world. And so I had actually called my office on Friday, just to give your listeners an inclination, on Good Friday, which, of course, none of this is lost on me now. You die on Good Friday and you get reborn on it. So on Good Friday, I called my office and I told them that I was not, and I felt all right. I was weeping convulsively in the week and I was, all this stuff happened. And I called them and I felt somewhat calm. And I said, I won't be coming back Monday as planned. And so my partner said, so when are you going to come back? Now, the interesting thing that happened that whole week, I hardly talked to anybody but my therapist. If I asked myself a question or if he asked me a question, the answer would come instantaneously with the force of thus says the Lord. And I would be most of the time surprised by what came out of my mouth. Well, he said to me, when are you coming back? If you're not coming on Monday, like planning, when will you be back? And I said, I'm not coming back. I'm going to die or be institutionalized. And believe me, when I heard myself say that, man, my head exploded and I was weeping and weeping, but that's how bad things got. It was really a book of Job kind of a journey, but of course, a lot of times that's what you have to do is you have to hit bottom, before you're willing to completely utterly throw yourself into God's hands. So that's what I did. Actually somebody told me, my mentor at Duke University told me about 8 months later, he said, when he heard my whole story, he said, I just thank the Lord that he's taken a gentler path with me. And after we left each other, I was weeping in gratitude and I couldn't help but praying. I said, Lord, I would go through a million times the agony I went through to find what I found on the other side.
And so the listening audience understands, what was the preparation of spending time at the monk? Did they prepare you for that?
Oh, absolutely. Father Christian was my spiritual director for those 2 years. And it was his advice and everything was priceless. You know, we went through all this stuff together for that 2 year period, and all this times that I spent a whole summer. I took a sabbatical from my, things got so bad for me. I took a sabbatical from my company. God bless my partners for keeping the place afloat. But I went and spent 3.5 months with the monks. That's what, so yeah, they were absolutely incredibly critical to my, to the whole thing. The whole thing was a process.
Right, right. Okay, wonderful. And then let's go to the secondary, enlightenment, which is about the business success, the things you learned from Trappist monks about business success. And I looked a little into it, how you make the differentiation between making success happen and letting success happen.
Right, right. And that's why, because after this experience that I had, everything just, my whole life started just falling into place. After I had that spiritual experience, I sold my company and I sold it right before, I had two companies. We sold them right before the .com crash. And then about everything, I call them happy accidents. And then some kid one of my Duke students suggests I enter this writing contest and I win the $100,000 grand prize of the first thing I've ever tried to write in my life. And everything just kept falling into place. And one weekend I just sat down. I don't remember exactly why I did it, to tell you the truth. And I just said, why are these monks so damn good at business? I mean, they don't care about business. Their average age is 65. They only work 4 hours a day. They keep quiet. They probably most of them can't even spell the word business, yet everything they touch turns to money. Why is that? And I wrote what I thought was a white paper, and I gave it to some people. And then I get a telephone call from the editor at Forbes. And he said, somebody gave me this thing you wrote. I love it. And I want to publish it. It's too long for one article. So we want to make a 4-part article out of it. So Forbes publishes it, and he's the one that gave it the name, Business Secrets of the Trappist Monks, and it goes viral and becomes super successful. It was one of the most successful articles Forbes had ever published, and then that led to getting calls for people who wanted me to turn it into a book, and everything just fell, let success happen, and everything just kept falling into place, and I ended up publishing the book and I didn't even have an agent, I just got a telephone call from a guy at Columbia Business School. And Columbia Business School Publishing, which is part of Columbia University Press. And we published the book there. Now it's been translated into Brazil, Portuguese, Chinese, Korean, just came out in Spanish. It's been very, very successful. And then we decided to go back and take my brother John's essay that I wrote that won the Templeton Prize and turn that into a book. And that's been very successful. So, and then I was on the BBC, being interviewed on the BBC, kind of like what you're doing right now. And afterwards, the producer asked me to stay on the line. And she said, we really like what you had to say. How'd you like to become a contributor for the BBC? So I haven't auditioned or really tried to do anything in 22 years. Everything just kind of falls into place. And again, I think one of the questions you said you might ask me is, what is my definition of success, or how do you achieve success? And I said, you work as if it all depends on you, but you pray as if it all depends on God. And that second part is the really, really hard part. I mean, it's hard enough to be a really hard worker. Most people aren't that hard workers, but the second part of really, my favorite, probably with the psalm that we sing or we chant down at the monastery is, make justice your sacrifice and trust in the Lord. That's the secret. And living that way is a hard thing to do, though.
All right. So really put it together and clarify it for the listening audience, because I think a lot of people who have their own businesses or whatever they're doing, they want to be successful. And they're thinking, well, how do you let success happen? I know you defined it, but how do you go from making success happen to letting success happen?
First of all, what is success?
Well, right.
So the first thing, I have this concept in my book called Aim Past the Target. Success is the my definition of success is how selfless can you become. We're all born selfish, and we all move to some extent or another along the line towards selflessness. And the more selfless you become, the more successful you are. And the reason why the monks are so successful is they know that, you know, that the more successfully you forget your selfish motivations, the more successful you will become. It is in your own self-interest to forget your self-interest. Don't, you know, look at the, I came up through sales. I was fortunate enough to be on the cover of Selling Magazine. Every great salesman knows or should know that the secret to success is forgetting about your money, forget about your commissions, forget about your quota, even forget about your product, and concentrate on fanatically serving your customers' needs, and everything else will take care of itself. Seek first the kingdom of heaven, and everything else takes care of itself. Let's think about promotions and leadership, et cetera. People, I write about leadership for Forbes magazine. People always want to know, and so I ask them, why do you want to be a leader? Well, the fact is they usually want to be a leader for selfish reasons. Chicks will dig me if I'm a leader, or I'll get promoted faster if I'm a leader. I'll make more money if I'm a leader. No, the job of a leader is not to get yourself promoted. It's to get other people promoted.
Mm-hmm.
The better leader you are, the more you get other people promoted. And the more other people you get promoted, the faster you get promoted. So success in a material way is always a byproduct. It's a trailing indicator of living your life for something higher than business, something bigger than money, something bigger than what we mean by success, which is making it to the New York Stock Exchange or selling $1 million worth of whatever. No, that's not success. You know, I read an article for Forbes and I called it What Every Leader Must Know About Personal Development. And I said, the problem with all this talk about personal development is everybody wants, you know, how can I become personally developed? Why do you want to get so I can make more money? No, that's not the purpose. Personal development is the goal. Money's the side benefit, you know?
Well, exactly, exactly. And we also know that, you know, once you get all the money, you realize that how empty it is anyway, like you think you want it, but then you get it. And then you're like, this didn't solve my issues anyway.
Exactly. And so to me, I said, you know, Dostoevsky, who's my hero, you know, the great writer, the great Russian Dostoevsky, when he was 17 years old, he wrote to his older brother, he said, man is a mystery. If you spend your entire life trying to puzzle it out, do not say you wasted your time. I occupy myself with that mystery because I want to be a man. And I said, here's a guy who's saying all he wants out of life is to be a man. He didn't say I want to be a famous author. He was a famous author within 3 or 4 years of writing this letter. He didn't say, I want to be famous. I want to be money. I want to be a man. I want to be a complete human being. And that is the highest thing you can. And of course, you cannot accomplish that unless you're having your proper relationship with God. And so you seek first the kingdom of heaven, you know, and it's easy to get people's heads nodding about these issues. But then 2 minutes later, they're back with their head in the trough, worrying about, you know, he made more money than I did last week. You know, no, you have to live your life with this. And this is what the monks, you know, the monks have this, you know, of course, all Christianity talks about it, but the monks especially, they talk about formation. They don't talk about education. That's just intellectual knowledge. They talk about formation. Aristotle said, we are what we repeatedly do. Excellence is not a choice. It's a habit. It's who we become. And so it becomes a question of doing it and doing it and doing it. How did Brother John become such an incredibly selfless person? Because he behaved that way over and over and over till it becomes essential to him. It isn't a question of just, you know, hearing something and say, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Because we go, you know, we go to a lecture and somebody says how much healthier we'd be if we lost 30 pounds. We all nod our heads and we all say, yeah, that makes a hell of a lot of sense. Then we go out and get a potato chips, you know?
Right. That's the perfect segue into sort of my last question to wrap this up, which is, you know, I do a lot of coaching. And at the end of the day, when I ask people, why do you want, like, we're just talking about, why do you want that? Why do you want that? They say at the end of the day, Tracy, I just want to find lasting happiness. I just want to find an answer where I can have peace and happiness. And so what is your definition of what a happy self is? Because that's the name of this podcast.
Well, to me, a happy self is, well, I'll tell you how I discovered it for myself. a few years ago, I was going into my gymnasium. It was probably like 10 or 12 years ago. I was going into my gymnasium that I go to every single day. And this one day, there was a guy, an older man, who was handing out towels. Nobody ever hands out towels. There's always a stack there. This one day, he handed me the towel. And when I grabbed it, he didn't let go of it. And then he pulled me close to him, and he hissed into my face. He said, if you could be anywhere, doing anything, where would you be? What would you be doing right now? And without a moment's hesitation, I said, I'd be right here, right now, doing this. And he gave me the towel, and I headed down the hallway, and I started to cry. And I said, why are you crying? And I said, because you know that you are doing exactly with your life what you're supposed to be doing with your life. And that answer that you just gave that man came from instantaneously and from the deepest part of your being. And to me, that is my proudest achievement of my life. Not winning awards or selling companies or being a writer for Forbes or any of the others, or working for MTV. I worked for MTV when it started out. None of that stuff. Being able to look that man in the eye and say, I'd want to be here right now doing exactly what I'm doing right now. That's peace to know in your heart. And this is the transformation that I'm constantly talking about that you have to go through. All human beings are longing for transformation, but there's three kinds of transformation. When a thirsty man drinks, he transforms his condition. When a poor man hits the lottery, he transforms his circumstances. But when Mr. Scrooge wakes up on Christmas morning, an utterly new man, he has achieved a transformation of being. And what we're all really searching for is the transformation of being. And when you experience the transformation of being, then you'll know what happiness is.
Well, that is so well said. And I feel like we are just getting the tip of the iceberg, but our time is over. But I want to invite you back another time because you and I have a lot to talk about. This has been so profound and so interesting. Thank you so much for your time.
I loved every minute of it, Tracy. Thank you for having me on.
All right. We'll talk soon. Bye-bye.